I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears.
Hello, welcome to the Extra Credits Plus of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
So today is our final episode of Ridley Scott Month.
It is, yeah.
We began with a deep dive of my favorite film of all time, Alien, a great episode. Then we discussed the origins of Scott's career in our Napoleon episode, which was an absurd, hilarious film that people seem to continue misinterpreting.
Yeah, well, I think to be fair, a lot of that had to do with Napoleon coming out during the holiday season.
That's true.
Maybe people were going to the movies with their families, thinking that they were going to see a more historical, you know, drama, epic of Napoleon. Something, you know, like Gladiator from
That's a good point.
Ridley's filmography.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously it's a way more heightened comedic play on the idea of a great man.
It's much more like House of Gucci than it is Gladiator, even though it has its moments. So, yeah, I'm sad to stop talking about Scott, but I guess we get to continue talking about the hilarious 86-year-old filmmaker next year with Gladiator 2.
Yeah, I was just going to say Gladiator 2 is coming out. We'll have Paul Mescal conversations.
Oh, hell yeah. I guess we can do After Sun.
That's true. On Patreon. We've never talked about that on mic.
Well, that was one of our most downloaded episodes last year.
But I know,
it was
you just did
me
a solo pod
for 30 minutes just talking about my childhood. So yeah, I would love to do a deep dive on that Patreon episode. But today, we are ending our 2023 talk of Ridley Scott on the podcast by exploring one of the most important dystopian science fiction films ever made, and that is the 1982 movie Blade Runner. This is a movie that I revisited three times this week. I watched a few documentaries. I read probably one too many academic level breakdowns or essays on the film. And I also tried to consume a little bit of a negative commentary about Blade Runner because I was trying to understand different perspectives on the film, because while I think it is pretty great, I do understand that it's not for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even some who seem to love it, I noticed, like listening to podcasts or reading essays, they seem to like talking about its ideas more than the actual film itself, which is interesting.
I think that I am in that camp because I really respect it. And I think that the ideas are really impressive. And we'll obviously talk more today about like what Ridley Scott is trying to say about class and why it's such an interesting sci-fi dystopian story. But I think there are some pacing things that it just is a sleepy movie in terms of the world. It's raining. It's dark.
It's perpetually raining and dark. Yeah.
I fell asleep during like trying to rewatch this. And some of that also had to do with, you know, me being tired. I just did all my finals. Listeners maybe know from like previous podcasts. So I pulled a lot of like 4 a.m. mornings.
Yeah, you've been so busy.
So that may have had something to do with it. But in general, I have seen people say like maybe they get bored in certain spots. And like, I think that is understandable. But ultimately, the rewatch that I had, because I rewatched it twice for the podcast, the last rewatch, I think I respected it the most. And maybe that's because I knew I was going to talk about it. So it was more exciting and fun to look at like certain pieces or details I hadn't before and like get excited to talk to you about it. Yeah. But I do think that personally, I fall in the camp of maybe enjoying talking about it more than watching it because of the slow pacing.
I think that's interesting because it is a really moody movie. And so I understand why people could, you know, be a little bit detached from it or even fall asleep in moments with pacing issues. I really tried to reflect on my relationship to it this past week of watching it so many times because I realized that I just had such a weird journey with this movie, almost like it's a Christopher Nolan film where I've vacillated from liking it to then loving it to then questioning whether or not that I was a film bro for liking this movie to now I think I'm in a place similar to you in terms of admiration. I feel that I am like unapologetically admiring the enormity of the movie and like what its characters represent, what it's saying about ecological disaster, what it's saying about labor commentaries, what it's saying about gender politics, about our contemporary world. Mm-hmm. And also outside of the vacuum of the film, I think we both just love to talk about the informal universe of Alien and Blade Runner.
Oh yeah.
They're two films that are connected in a ton of ways.
Yeah. I think, yes, this is a personal, I think, franchise favorite for both of us. We love Prometheus. We love
Covenant too.
Covenant. Yeah. We love the Alien franchise in general, Blade Runner and the connections. So we, you know, personally get joy from just doing research on the connections between these worlds.
Yeah.
But I think just like aside from the movie in terms of the pacing and like details that we'll get into today, I do want to just take a minute to talk about how it is a very unique dystopian sci-fi film.
Yeah.
And even though I just said I fell asleep during the movie while I was rewatching it, I do think that it really deserves to be on like a different tier of sci-fi in mm-hmm. terms of how it approaches the subject matter from a more macro level.
Yeah.
And there's not really a protagonist or antagonist to attach to. Yeah. Like there is when you first watch it, maybe you are, you know, you kind of like misread what is happening mm-hmm. in the story because you're looking for plot beats and character arcs that you are used to seeing in a narrative. But I think that this movie is so special because there really isn't someone to attach to, and it's really more so less of a character study and more of a concept study.
That's a really good point. It is distancing, which is, I'm surprised to hear you say that because you love 2049. That's like one of, that's in your bag. That's like one of your favorite movies of all time.
Yeah. Well, I think that Blade Runner 2049 is interesting, Denis' movie with Ryan Gosling, because Ryan Gosling's character, Kay, is actually someone that the audience can attach to.
Yeah.
Right? Like we're very much seeing the world through his eyes and the reflection of him being a replicant or not.
Yeah.
Or what does it mean to be human? Like asking those questions through his character and empathizing with his character.
Yeah.
And this movie is doing that, but it's asking you those questions on like a concept level because you're not attaching really to Deckard.
Yes.
But I think the reason I like 2049 more is really just, I mean, it's unfair. It was made later. The visual effects, it's like
it
so
sounds incredible too.
Amazing to be in that world, especially if you ever get a chance to see Blade Runner 2049 in theaters. It is so immersive. Yeah. I mean, actually probably this Blade Runner, you know, 82 would also be a similar theater experience, but we went for Trey's birthday last year and it was just
an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Truly.
Wild like to see it with the speakers in the theater. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we first saw it in theaters in 2017, we were kind of blown away. I mm-hmm. immediately went home and was like, I want to, you know, fire up 82 Blade Runner because I want to see how it stands up. But they are kind of different films in that way. I like what you said about Ryan Gosling's character Kay, because I think what Denis and Ridley do with 2049, because Ridley's an executive producer and he was on the set like every day on that film. I think what they do is really smart, which is they basically are like, let's take Rachel and let's take Roy Batty from the 82 mm-hmm. version and let's make them the protagonist of 2049 and mm-hmm. let's like follow their kind of journey to yeah. recognizing whether or not they are human. What does that mean to be human? So yeah, I think going back to 82 Blade Runner, this is a very quiet and moody film, like I said, and I get why it's not for everyone. I think going off what you said, I really enjoyed on rewatch the nuance of building an atmosphere through every sonic and visual and technical choice that is made. But the choices are so depressive and kind of putting you in this like run down environment with this perpetual rainfall, mm-hmm. acid rain from this potential, like I guess this nuclear holocaust yeah. that happened in World War, whatever it is. So I understand why Blade Runner is kind of a tough sit for a lot of people. But I do think that one of the reasons I come back to Ridley Scott and one of the reasons I come back to this informal franchise and specifically 82 Blade Runner, and I'm just constantly and consistently blown away by the movie, is that Scott is and his collaborators are singular in mainstream epic filmmaking in the ways that they try to use big studio budgets to the best of their ability to paint the largest of stories in the massive, like in massive epics, like Blade Runner, Alien, Prometheus, mm-hmm. Covenant, and then obviously his work with Denis on 2049. These are all films that lack conventional character development. And instead, where they lack that development in characters, they excel in provocative questions.
Yeah.
That you really don't see too often in big budget escapist studio films, because usually they're escapists. They're there for people to kind of go out after a long day of work, check out, feel like they just were entertained, and then go home and maybe have a feeling of an idea that they can walk away from. And Blade Runner and Prometheus and 2049 and Alien, these movies look great and they are entertaining in certain moments, but ultimately they are like deeply philosophical in like what they're asking. And that can be pretentious and indulgent for a lot of people. But for me, I think it's a ton of fun.
Yeah. And we've said this on Ridley Scott podcast before, but the reason why I respect him as a filmmaker and his filmography is that even though he, you know, obviously has misses like politically, tonally, thematically, are certainly movies in his filmography that I'm not like uplifting by any means, but
like the Columbus movie, for example, or like Exodus, Gods and Kings, or Robin Hood.
Yeah, exactly. But I think on the whole, you can definitely see a difference in themes from Ridley Scott's filmography and his cohort of people who, you know, are acclaimed as auteurs. Like, he is less likely to look at the individual and kind of romanticize a human story, which are also obviously maybe necessary too in terms of uplifting stories. But he's less likely to have a sentimental tone or ending to his movies. And he's far less interested in the individual and way more interested in structures. His movies are usually about like class or gender and power or religion.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating about Scott is that he's so flippant in the public. And he kind of has been identified as an asshole, even himself. Like, he talks about himself as one, like he owns a French vineyard and makes $250 million movies that are a little bit like his own personal political manifestos. But something that I've respected about his career is that he's not as interested in myth making and trying to create this like facade of a do-gooder, like a local artist that still is paying his bills check to check. Like, I don't think he is interested in romanticizing himself as an artist. And sometimes in this industry, like, filmmakers that are the most lauded and praised come Oscar season, and the ones that make the most money too, those filmmakers who have been working for 30, 40, 50 years can sometimes be talking about themselves, and others can talk about them as these very, well-intended artists that aren't actually millionaires.
Yeah, they like put them on a pedestal, kind of. And it feels like they're kind of on a lifelong Oscar campaign.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes I feel like it's good to acknowledge, and Scott does this all the time, that he is working within a brutal system.
Yeah.
And he's using the capital of an exploitative studio system. And he knows it really well because he spent 20 years of his adult life doing advertising and marketing. And he didn't actually make Alien until he was like 40 years old. Mm-hmm. And he saw awful things in this industry. And so while I respect his cohort and how they provoke and inspire conversations about film and the history of film and inspire future artists, I do think Ridley Scott gets mischaracterized as like an indulgent, prolific filmmaker that is more style over substance. And I think that maybe if we all just gave higher standards to how honest our filmmakers should be, who are, you know, in this business for 30 or 40 years, then we'd all probably respect Scott a little bit more. Because when you look at blockbusters today, there aren't any Blade Runners. Like, when you look at $200-300 million movies today, there are some that are provocative and can be transgressive in moments, but most of them feel more escapist than thoughtful or even educational, which I'm not going to, that's a big word to use for Blade Runner, but this movie does provoke conversation at a really high level.
Yeah.
And it's very rare we get that in Mission Impossible 7 or John Wick 4. Yeah. And no offense to those like very good films.
We love those movies.
Yeah. But how much space are they taking in theaters? Like, how much space are they taking in studios allocating their budgets to have this like consistent revenue pull in and for their shareholders? Like, there is something about Scott's movies, especially today's film, Blade Runner, that is a little bit radical, a little bit revolutionary, and a little bit timeless. But because I think of the way he presents himself in the public sphere, he's kind of reduced, you know, as this just commercial filmmaker.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get into Blade Runner 1982. This is a film set in a postmodern society where a few humans get to play God, mm-hmm. like Tyrell. It seems consumerism has fully become a religion in itself, and the human experience has just been reduced to constructs and mm-hmm. has been commodified in its entirety. There's a lot to talk about. So as always, our Extra Credits Plus episodes are deep dives, but they are also live commentaries. So we will be discussing Blade Runner while watching it. So for any listeners who want to listen and watch, you can stream the movie, or you can own it for $5 on Blu-ray through Barnes & Noble right now.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace to physical media,
yeah.
because it's leaving Best Buy and Barnes & Noble. It's honestly really sad.
We're clearing out.
We are. We have spent yeah. a lot of money this holiday season.
Yeah.
Just we need more bookshelves to hold all of our Blu-rays and 4Ks. I recommend owning this Blade Runner film on 4K because it's pretty unreal. So,
well, before we get started, should we tell people the version that we are watching?
Oh, yes. Before I get into that, because that's a whole other story, I guess I'll do that before we even play the movie. That's a mm-hmm. good idea. But listeners, if you're on the main feed, that means you're listening to the first 30 minutes of this episode. If you would like to hear the full 2 hour plus episode, you can go into the description. You'll find our Patreon, the Extra Credits Plus, where you can join us on Living Plus to get access to all of our 2 to 3 hour deep dives we publish on there, including today's episode. All right, so there are tons of versions of this film, and I've already gotten messages about like which version we were doing mm-hmm. In lead up to this episode. Blade Runner 1982 had a ton of offset problems and onset problems. It was a pretty tough production with a lot of financing issues. Ridley Scott was also a bit tyrannical on set. There was a feud between the crew at large,
mm-hmm.
Specifically between Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott for sure. And there was a lot of issues with Sean Young too, not on her end, but on how she was treated. And ultimately, Scott was fired right before the film hit theaters in a really wild way. So there's a lot going on this movie, which is, you know, it hopefully that makes sense to why there's so many different versions. It really wasn't because of any of the drama on set. Like, Ridley Scott was fired more so because of disrespecting, I guess, some of the producers
mm-hmm.
and the studio execs who funded the film, who kept trying to alter it. And he would literally like have sets be remade toward the end of shooting.
Yeah, he went way over budget, right?
Right. The movie was supposed to only be like a $15 to $20 million budget. It went to $30 to $40. And then with marketing, was probably closer to like $60 to $70. And the movie only made like $20, $25 million. So it lost a ton of money. And the financiers throughout the movie process were really frustrated because they did not trust Scott's vision and they did not trust the atmosphere building of the film. There's a lot of quiet scenes, which is maybe why Kelsey fell asleep. I've never fell asleep with this movie, but I have felt those moments. And apparently in those moments, like, I don't even need to give you an example because there are several in this film of quiet moments that you're just looking at this eerie dystopia version of LA. The producers added voiceover throughout the entire film so the audiences would try to connect to the characters more and get into the,
or like,
I guess, inner monologue of Harrison Ford.
Right, what Deckard was doing, yeah.
Yeah, so Deckard is a very quiet character throughout the film. And so they gave him a lot of monologues. They also wanted to include more sex scenes. They wanted to include a lot more nudity. And Ridley Scott just didn't want any of those things. But mainly the voiceover really irritated him. So again, Scott was fired a few times because, as people know, Ridley Scott, he is a very pushy communicator. And
yeah.
So he found his way back onto set, but
then
was taken off.
We've often joked about him being Logan Roy on the podcast.
Yes, he's the Logan Roy of directors.
Of Living Plus.
But apparently what happened in 1982 is there was an awful early screening and people hated the film. They hated the voiceover, and Scott talked his way back into the production and was hired back on, and he modified some of the voiceover and he made some sound design changes and made some small edits with the team of producers and collaborators. And there's a lot to talk about with all of the production. We'll get into that in today's episode. But basically, this movie has undergone several versions since its original release in 1982. You can rent or purchase most of those versions online, which is so weird to me because there is so clearly a best version.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just run through the main four. The first one is the theatrical cut in 1982, which is the version released in theaters. That's the one that I've been talking about with a ton of studio interference. People hated this movie. Had terrible reviews from critics at large, didn't make any money. Scott was openly pissed off in the public with the final product, as were the screenwriters Hampton Fancher and co-writer David Peoples. cinematographer Jordan Cronenweth, editor Terry Rawlings, basically the whole crew was
even
pretty
Harrison
furious.
Ford, he didn't like the voiceover that they included, right?
Not only did he not like the voiceover, So they wanted his voiceover just to give more depth to the movie and character development, but they also wanted voiceover because he's coming off of Raiders of the Lost Ark and his two Star Wars films, so his voice is very recognizable.
Okay.
And so they thought that would be a good selling trademark for this film to like have Harrison Ford's voice.
Have him explain the whole movie.
Basically, yeah, and every feeling Deckard had or didn't have. And they wanted to make it more accessible in that way. And so, yeah, so Harrison Ford with Ridley Scott, apparently, this is the story, they talked before the theatrical release in post-production, and Ford told Ridley Scott that he was just going to phone it in. And maybe I can just play some of Ford's voiceover here so people can just hear it. It's honestly hilarious. So here's Ford genuinely trying to throw the movie.
New climate. Recreational facility.
They don't advertise for killers in a newspaper. That was my profession. Ex-cop. Ex-Blade Runner. Ex-killer.
Okay, so that was Ford. You can kind of understand why probably that this movie went through such a difficult time in its early screening because he sounds like he just doesn't care.
Yeah, super monotone.
Apathetic, yeah. And then there was a second version around the same time in 82, the international cut, which was released worldwide. Similar to the theatrical cut, but there were some violent scenes and extended sequences. I have never seen that version of the film, but apparently this was just a more graphic version of Blade Runner, which sounds interesting. Then the third version, this is the third one, for the 10-year anniversary, we get Blade Runner, the director's cut.
Yeah.
This one is very interesting. It has a fun backstory. It had nothing to do with Ridley Scott, yet it is called the director's cut. Apparently the story goes, a theater in LA was showing a print of Blade Runner, and they asked the distributor for a copy, and the distributor accidentally gave that theater the copy that Ridley Scott made for the trailers back in 82, which has his original dark ending. It doesn't have any of the voiceover,
right.
And the sound design is better because there isn't any voiceover they had to mix in it. And it plays at the theater in LA, and people go crazy for it. And they're like, this is a different ending.
Yeah.
There's no voiceover. And then multiple theaters across the country start asking for that cut. And the studios are like, okay, let's monetize this mistake and let's make some money since we lost so much in 82, 10 years ago from this film not doing well at the box office. And so they make this movie. They sell it on DVD called The Director's Cut. Which is funny, again, because Ridley Scott had nothing to do with it. And the studio did one thing that continued to piss Ridley Scott off in the director's cut, which is they kept the voiceover. They changed the ending, but they kept the voiceover.
Yeah.
Which I'm convinced, there's nothing like this online. The studio has not said this, but I'm convinced they just did this to piss off Ridley Scott. Because they're publicly not liking each other back in 82, so it kind of makes sense to me. And so this actually kind of helps Ridley Scott's career in a lot of ways because he had a really rough decade of making pretty poor movies through 82 to 92. And then he comes back after the director's cut, has a little bit more of that kind of like artistic license to do a little bit more different things. He makes Thelma and Louise. He makes Gladiator years later, and he becomes like a very well-received filmmaker again. And that's the three cuts right there before we get the cut we're watching today, which is called The Final Cut, which was released in 2007 for the 25-year anniversary. And this is the movie that Ridley Scott says is his definitive version. It looks fantastic. It has been
so good on 4K.
I don't understand how this movie... I mean, that's what everybody says. I'm being repetitive here, but like so many people have said this, but it does look fantastic.
Yeah.
Like it looks phenomenal. It's remastered. It's been restored back to the original intentions of the artist who made it. There's no voiceover, no happy ending. And apparently the executives who were angry at Ridley throughout the 80s and 90s no longer worked for the studio anymore. So they let him come in with all of his old collaborators, remove all of the issues that they had. And because it's also 2007, they also incorporate some improved special effects. So that might be why it looks a little bit better too in the theatrical. And they also remove some continuity errors in the edit. So they basically get to make the movie they wanted to make in 82, but with better technology.
Yeah. And apparently in the new version, there are some things that are edited in to, you know, give more suspense to the story. Like in the end fight scene, there's just a building, I guess, in the original cut, but in the new version, Roy Batty is in the window. I always say
it sounds like
Roy
Batty.
Yeah. Batty is
I mean the replicants.
Yeah, except for Leon.
Well, not Leon, yeah.
But
tough look for Leon.
You'd think they'd make all their replicants hot. You know what I mean? Anyway, apparently in the end fight sequence, they put Roy Batty in the window looking up at Harrison Ford to add more tension to
in
that
final
last
cut?
Fight sequence. This is my very limited research. I was looking at some like side-by-side images.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching Blade Runner, the Final Cut, which again is the most authentic representation of Scott's intended movie experience for this film. So again, you can rent or purchase the Final Cut. Literally, it's just called Blade Runner, the Final Cut. Do not rent Blade Runner if it doesn't say the Final Cut, because I have heard people do that and you just watch the theatrical version and it's a lot worse. All right, let's do this. We're going to start the film on play. 3, 2, 1, play. All right. So per usual on this live commentary episode that we do, all these episodes we do on Patreon, we are watching the film with subtitles because we don't want anybody hearing the sound of the film, and we hate headphones when doing podcasting.
Yeah.
We are jumping right into the film with a great score that we cannot hear. And I've tried to take some notes along the way to try to remind myself to talk about the score. But let's talk about Vangelis first, who's the composer. You hear his music booming in the opening credits and title sequence of this film. And listening to the commentary from Ridley Scott on the 4K is really funny, because he's like, let's just fucking get into it. Like, he's like, I didn't want to mess around with the beginning of this film. I just wanted you to feel it. So I don't know if a movie that we've covered on Patreon has had a score that is this integral to the film being successful. Because the movie really relies on atmosphere. And so Vangelis, the composer, I think does something sort of groundbreaking in this film for the industry. I think obviously the futuristic environment of Blade Runner inspires science fiction to this day, but the score of this film, I think, informs a lot of the more introspective science fiction works that we get over the next four decades. And obviously there's been a lot of electronic music and science fiction before Blade Runner, but not quite like this. Like the use of synthesizers and the electronic orchestral music really, I think, does a good job of adding to the themes of this film.
Yeah, and especially because we've talked about in this film in particular, there are slower moments, because I think to its credit, like, it is invested in the world building.
Yeah.
But the music does a lot for it to keep the suspense and to keep the kind of intrigue in this completely different world that feels fully realized.
Yeah, I really also enjoy the fact that it adds to the atmosphere. Ultimately, like, it adds to this kind of like bizarre futuristic vibe that almost sounds like something uncanny a little bit. And it almost feels like the score is like this imitation of humanity, you know, between like the conflict of what is more human in this film, the bioengineered replicant, or the imitation of like what a human is supposed to be. I feel like the music really adds to those questions. So it's just like a phenomenal grand anthem of despair and possibility.
Yeah. I have a question for you. So with these like text scrolls that we see at the top of a lot of older movies, but specifically the Blade Runner movie, I always get stressed when
reading all of
any
it. Yeah,
kind of text shows up on screen. I'm like,
me too.
I have to read so fast.
Yeah,
and I get anxious, and then like feel like I can't finish reading fully, or I'm not like investing in comprehension of what is being told to me. So like, I feel like, you know, to be fair, actually the other night. Well, this is funny. The other night when I was watching Blade Runner 2049, I was like, I'm not reading all this. I took a picture of it and I like made my phone read it to me.
I heard that downstairs. I was upstairs and I was like, what is that? Is Kelsey listening to Blade Runner, like an AI, like Siri telling her about Blade Runner?
Yeah.
Just so listeners are keeping up with us, the opening text that sets up the narrative and conflict for the film tells us that we're in this 2019 futuristic LA dystopia. Mm-hmm. It's early in the 21st century. The Tyrell Corporation advanced robot evolution into the Nexus phase, which we learn is a being virtually identical to being human, which is going to be referred to as a replicant throughout the film. Mm. Basically, the text goes on to this. Hello there. Sorry for interrupting.
Thank you for listening so far, and hopefully you are enjoying the episode so far. I feel like maybe if you made it this far.
They got it this far. They're having a good time.
I mean, let's hope. But to access our full conversation, you can go to the description of this episode to join our Patreon community. the Extra Credits Plus.
Yes, and for only $5 a month, you can get access to our full catalog of Patreon exclusive episodes. Hope to see you there.